This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, Tisha Week. We're talking about medical music therapy today. So the use of music as medicine has existed for as long as the indigenous communities in our country have been creating music. However, formalized music therapy only started in Malaysia about two decades ago by way of Western-trained music therapists and is still in its infancy in terms of its therapeutic usage. So we'll be discussing the use and benefits of medical music therapy today with two guests, a very special one all the way from Florida State University, Dr. Laurie Gooding, an assistant professor of music therapy, as well as Dr. Indra Selvaraja, medical music therapist from University Putra, Malaysia. Good afternoon to the both of you. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is not your first time speaking to BFM about this topic, but I think what we like to look at today is really how do you think medical music therapy can be integrated into our healthcare system, how you foresee medical music therapists working with mainstream healthcare professionals and as well as allied health professionals and providing that very complete system of care for patients who need it and for their family members as well. So perhaps just to set the basis of what we're going to talk about today, what is medical music therapy? And we've talked about music therapy before, but the addition of the word medical, what difference does it make?
Well, music therapy, just a reminder for your audience, is the use of music to reach functional, non-musical goals. And so medical music therapy is simply a subspecialty of music therapy in which we target those with healthcare needs. It could be physical, it could be mental health, but we are addressing needs specific to illness and the treatment process.
Okay. And what is the area of study that is at the heart of medical music therapy? Which area of medicine would you say drives it?
Well, one of the things that we are exposed to as part of training is that we have to do a whole gamut of medical-based courses, and that includes anatomy and physiology. That also includes a lot of... I did a course, I remember, on biopsychology, and also medical rehabilitation, and these are quite standard for the training. That, of course, is complemented by a lot of other psychology-based courses, as much as music courses. And what we find is it's really an amalgamation of different areas of training that come together, including counseling skills. In fact, quite a lot of us go on to take extended counseling training simply because you're dealing with a biopsychosocial approach to treatment, and that is what we find is the most comprehensive. And at Florida State University, they offer not only courses in the College of Music that will cater to the specific training of music therapists, but we also have all these faculties of medicine, faculties of educational psychology, faculty of social work, and so forth, in which we often take supplementary courses to form the total approach.
So can I ask each of you to tell me how you came into this field?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've been a music therapist for just a little over 20 years now. And growing up, I actually had a teacher that told me about music therapy. So that's how I learned about it. Because at that point in time in the United States, it wasn't widely known. And I was very interested in music, but I was also very interested in psychology and medicine. And music therapy truly is a blending of all three of those things. You get to meld healthcare with psychological aspects with music, and you don't have to give up one for the other.
Mm.
And I think that's very common for many music therapists, is they have interest in all of those areas, and they get to blend them into something that actually makes a difference in people's lives.
In yourself, Dr. Indra?
Well, for me, I've always had this interest in music therapy ever since I did my undergraduate and my master's training in the UK, where I was exposed to music therapy as an elective course, and it just blew me away. But at that time, I didn't envision much of a prospect to come home to Malaysia and practice as a music therapist. So I went on to do my master's, and it was really a combination of music performance and music psychology, because as much as I was interested to learn how to teach more effectively and to understand things from a performance side, I also wanted to understand the underlying psychological mechanisms. Why are some students more receptive to teaching than others? Why do we call some students more musical? And what could I do using the psychological approach to better reach out to them and help them? And I did do a minor as well in psychology while I was in the UK. So I decided to just combine the two during my master's. And when I came home, it was that psychology aspect that when I first applied for jobs, that University Putra Malaysia, among the other universities that I applied, were really, really interested in that. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that back then, and this was in 1999, they had already had the inkling that this would be a course that would be important to teach. So they roped me in to teach psychology of music, and they had an introduction to music therapy course that had already been developed for the program, but they had no one to teach it.
Mm.
So I made it very clear for them. I said, at that stage, I'm not a music therapist, so I can teach you based on the principles, more on the knowledge side for exposure, but I refuse to do any clinical training because I'm not qualified at that point. But at least I can, you know, present the students some kind of understanding of what music therapy is. I myself believe that it was important. But it was in 2005 when we had an opportunity between UPM, UITM and UM to organise the International Society of Music Education conference in Kuala Lumpur. So we were all excited about it. I was fortunate enough to be roped in to be part of the organising committee. And I saw that they were actually going to be offering the ISMEI Commission of Music and Special Education and Music Therapy. And I grabbed the chance to bring it to Malaysia and to offer it so that hopefully we could spread the benefits to the masses. And it was during that commission seminar that we organised in UPM that we were exposed on a wider scale to all these different ways that music was being used, including music therapy and music and special education. And it just so happened one of the professors there was from Florida State University, Professor Alice Ann Darrow. And it was Professor Darrow, credit to her, who actually reached out to me and said, have you ever thought of going into music therapy? So things started from there, and I had wonderful support from the university, and ultimately the government sent me on scholarship to do the training. So that really started the ball rolling.
How much more of training did you require to finally qualify as a medical music therapist? Because on top of the foundation that you already have.
Sure. So when I went to Florida State University, it was after doing the research and trying to see, well, what school would best serve the purposes of what I envisioned at that point was Malaysia's needs. And it became very clear that going into a program like Florida State University's, which was very, very established as far as not just music therapy as a whole, but what I surmised was if you want to do medical music therapy, that's probably the place to go. And it has a very, very extensive internship network as well. And so everything that I've applied and brought back home since then is really a translation of the teaching and the training I received, which I found to be extremely comprehensive. And that has been extremely helpful.
Is there any training available here in Malaysia?
Not at this point. But what we try to do is to provide, through UPM, a music therapy career pathway. And what I mean by that is we have an undergraduate program that runs. It's more of a general music degree, although traditionally UPM is known more for its performance. But at this point, our current revamp of the program is a Bachelor of Music. After the students come in for 2 years and we've given them that basic grounding in musicianship and theory and all those things that are important to be a fully developed musician, then they start to select their pathways. And so music therapy is one option. And ultimately, what I do is to provide them with the kind of exposure, because there are courses already in our program that enable students to learn a bit about music therapy to get that initial introduction. And from there, I organize community outreach activities in which I take them out with me to get more hands-on experience. But what happens after that is they will culminate with a final year project, which will be based on a music therapy type topic. It's not pure music therapy research, but it's going in the direction of venturing into music therapy. And that is meant to be the platform to help them to apply to go overseas to do their full-blown training.
Okay.
So we do it in a very systematic way, but also to ensure that if they really are serious and want to do music therapy, we try to create that pathway. But then once we have been able to put them on that pathway, then we send them to a program that's accredited.
Dr. Laurie, medical music therapy seems to be one of several ways that music is used in the healing sense, in the healthcare sense. You've mentioned music in special education, music therapy, music psychology. I was also introduced to the term health musicking. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to know what that means and how does medical music therapy fall under that?
In terms of music in healthcare, there are a number of different ways to approach using music within a healthcare setting. And so music therapists have a very systematic training, and we address a clinical goal. So it might be pain management, it might be anxiety, various other things like that. Some of the other methods also provide very valuable uses of music and provide opportunities to interact in music. And so it might be, for example, music and medicine, which is provided by non-music therapists. And so it's not as it's not as individualized use of music as a music therapist would use, but they're still using music more broadly to address quality of life, well-being, that sort of thing. Musicking comes into play in that it's where individuals have the opportunity to actively engage in making music. And so you might actively engage. Music therapists would use musicking in a more clinical sense to address clinical needs. A music educator might use musicking to create social interaction opportunities. Through that musicking, we are able to see improvements in either those clinical goals or things like wellness, quality of life, improved social interactions, those types of things.
Okay. I'm speaking to Dr. Laurie Gooding, Assistant Professor of Music Therapy from Florida State University in the United States, as well as Dr. Indra Selvaraja, a medical music therapist from University Putrajaya, Malaysia. We've hardly gone into how music therapy is used in medicine, which I really want to get into when we come back from the break. We'll be right back here on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to Health and Living with me, Tishao Ik. I'm discussing medical music therapy today with two very special guests, Dr. Laurie Gooding, Assistant Professor of Music Therapy from Florida State University, as well as Dr. Indra Selvaraja, a medical music therapist from University Putra, Malaysia, and also with the Malaysian Society for Music in Medicine, the MSMM. So we'll get a little more into what the MSMM does in Malaysia later, but the idea of using music in healing in different areas of medicine. But first to understand, what exactly is the effect of music on the brain? And I think that would be the understanding that paves the way for using music for healing, for its healing properties, right? So,
absolutely.
Yeah, what exactly is the effect of music on the brain as well as physically on the body?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one that music therapists are really excited about because the research into music and the brain has increased dramatically in the last 10 to 20 years. And so we're getting a better understanding of what it is that music or being engaged in music actually does. So there are a number of different things. We know that music activates the reward system in the brain. And so that makes participating in music activities very motivating. We know that music can impact hormone levels in the body, for example, cortisol, which is one of the stress hormones. We know that it can actually change the ratio of the amount of cortisol in the body. And then there are a number of different ways. We have seen stabilization in things like oxygen saturation when patients are listening to music. There is some research that suggests there may be an impact on a heart rate, although that's still being determined, but there's some suggestions that it might. And there are a number of different things as well in terms of the usefulness in music actually engaging the brain. Probably the most exciting one is there is a great amount of research on music and neuroplasticity. So the ability of the brain to make and strengthen connections. And that's happens particularly because music engages a variety of aspects of the brain. So you have motor aspects, auditory aspects, cognitive, et cetera. And because all of those systems are engaged at once, it interacts or engages the brain in ways that some other activities don't necessarily do. And that gives us an advantage as a tool, of using music as a tool to actually help strengthen connections. For example, after a stroke, when there's been damage, we can create new pathways for an individual to do something like walking or talking again through music.
Well, that's very exciting.
Yeah, it is.
So, Dr. Indra, perhaps you can elaborate on that, because I did want to find out different areas of medicine that you would use music therapy in, perhaps taking the stroke example and how that actually plays out.
So what we are doing right now in Malaysia is at a hospital like Cheras Rehab. They have actually got a full-blown rehabilitation hospital. They are trying to run the kind of idealized stroke recovery program for our Malaysian population. And they have an allied health team in place. So when I was brought in, one of the things that they called for was actually some form of music therapy support for stroke rehabilitation. And it was under the neuro rehabilitation unit. I also work with traumatic brain injury patients. And so for stroke patients, primarily, I'm looking at what their primary diagnosis is, in terms of after they have determined what kind of stroke it might be, whether it's a ischemic stroke, whether it's a hemorrhaging stroke, because dependent on where the actual damage is in the brain, that will determine where there is potential for certain types of functioning that could be impaired. And what is extremely important is for a music therapist like myself to work alongside the medical team to also understand not just the origin of the point of damage and the areas or aspects of functioning that could be compromised. And in stroke, it's typically speech. Mm-hmm. That's one that if there is a left hemisphere damage, then you would expect there would be some kind of speech impairment. There could be partial paralysis, you know, hemiparesis, hemiplegia. There could be also problems with walking as a result. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes what we do with those two different things is there are tried and tested evidence-based music therapy techniques that we would target specifically speech, for example. And there are many, many techniques, such as from neurologic music therapy, where they have what we call melodic intonation therapy. And you're working specifically at using tones and rhythm. And these are elements of music that can be manipulated and can be systematically presented in a way that actually rebuilds speech in stages. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole procedure. And there are also other ways that you might use, like in Unistry Putra Malaysia, what we've done is we've developed a voice rehabilitation protocol. And that is originally designed for Parkinson's disease, but the implications for stroke are very, very strong because there are many, many similarities in some of the characteristics we've observed. The reason why I mentioned that is because one of our main goals was actually to try to find locally validated research. One thing we really, really lack are ways to translate all these music therapy techniques that have been designed and developed in countries such as the US, which is, you know, the most advanced when it comes to medical music therapy, but to be able to translate that into a Malaysian context so we could use it effectively for our own local patients. And that's extremely important, the validation process. But what we found is that because something like singing, for example, if we are working with a stroke patient who that has a speech impairment, is not something that people usually associate with therapy. Yes. And for the most part, the stroke patient is already going through so much. Mm-hmm. And they are probably feeling confused, frustrated, on top of the fact that they're having problems expressing themselves through their speech. So using singing and using music as a fun activity on the surface, but that ultimately we embed a lot of speech rehabilitation goals into the singing so that they are actually practicing and working on their speech without even realizing that it's part of their rehab program. Mm-hmm. We find we get a much better response because It's motivating, it's engaging. In fact, when I was called into Churras Rehab, that was one of the main things that I was informed by their allied health team. The level of motivation and engagement in treatment was low. As far as patients needing to go into rehab, it seems counterintuitive in some ways because these patients are already compromised in some way because they have weakness, they have difficulties even trying to keep up with the treatment requirements, and they are required to go into active rehab, and it's so intensive. So what we went in to do was really to use music as a supportive ally to the primary treatment to encourage them to actually practice and to reinforce their rehab goals. And we were so encouraged to see that the response has been tremendous, and they've actually asked us to expand the program.
So from your observation, did the introduction of music as a form of therapy increase the motivation of the patients?
Absolutely. And what happened when we first started out, because, you know, this is serious. We are working with vulnerable patients. So we weren't immediately allowed to go into the hospital and start working with patients. And what we did was smaller workshops and short sessions, first with the medical staff, to at least explain to them how it works, to educate them. And then subsequently, we were allowed, you know, to go and work with limited numbers of patients. And now, on average, we have about 40 over patients in a session. It's big. It's not perhaps what, in the long run, would be ideal, because we would prefer to, and this is actually where we're heading, to also have some one-to-one work so that we can individualize the kind of music therapy we do for the benefit of the patient. But it does mean that we find that repeatedly our sessions are full, and very often it is to the maximum capacity of the ward.
So, Dr. Laurie, I mean, you come from, you know, Florida State University is the lead, is one of the leaders in this area. So I'm assuming that, you know, the way that music therapy is done there is far advanced. Ideally, what should we be trying to reach for those kinds of tailored, individualized, one-to-one sessions?
Yeah, Indra is exactly on track with what needs to happen in terms of educating the community, the medical community, the broader community about what music therapy is and how to use it, and then developing sessions that highlight what music can do and how effective it can be, and then working with the staff to further educate them on different ways in which you can actually use music therapy. And that's one of the benefits of what we do, is you can address more than one goal or objective at a time. So there are cases when the group sessions are ideal, because you might be working on rehab from a sense of speaking again or walking again. But we also know, for example, with stroke patients, they're often struggling with depression and isolation. So that group setting allows Indra to and her students to address not only the rehabilitation goals, but the psychosocial aspects as well, with depression, anxiety, isolation. But then adding on top of that, those one-to-one goals where you can really target and be more intense in terms of the treatment to produce faster results, broader results. So that combination of both group and individual in the medical setting is very important.
Yes. The group setting with the psychosocial aims, it brings to mind things like the drum circle. Is it similar?
There are differences between the drum circle and what we do as music therapists. For one, everything that we do in music therapy is goal-directed. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very specific. The techniques that we use are evidence-based. And the whole point of implementing the goals is to shape the client or the particular individual or the group that we're working with towards a non-musical goal that we may have in mind and would have pre-identified. I think there's a lot of good things that drum circles achieve. It is certainly something that adds to wellness and adds to a sense of community. And I've actually participated in drum circles, and I've seen drum circles are actually growing in Malaysia. I think all of that is good from a community perspective. And it's actually very important that as much as we have a lot of enthusiasm and interest in trying to explore more of the therapeutic uses of music, I think one of the most important things for us in the MSMM and UPM is to create the educational opportunities and to also provide training. Because at the end of the day, what is extremely important that we are all held accountable to is the safety and the well-being of the people we work with. Mm-hmm. We were talking a minute ago about stroke patients, mm-hmm. and I mentioned Parkinson's patients. And, you know, these are groups that are already in many ways limited in their ability to self-advocate, perhaps. And so the accountability that is expected of music therapists is such that when we go in and we use music therapeutically, mm-hmm. the training that goes in mm-hmm. and the level of expectation to be able to learn the ropes and the ways to administer music, even then, as I mentioned just now, and that was the right way of doing things when I went into children's rehab. Just because I had my music therapy training, they didn't just straight away let me go in and work with patients. They wanted to make sure that it aligned with what was needed in a medical setting. And that was the doctors doing their part and being responsible for the patients.
It should be as rigorous as any other any other profession operating in that setting.
Yes. So from that perspective, I think to what extent sometimes people confuse drum circles with music therapy, I think it is also our job to do more to educate. And I always believe in empowering, because as much as we want to see more opportunities, more platforms for our society to be able to benefit from different ways of music making, whether it's health musicking, whether it's music therapy per se, and then to be able to be empowered at a level where they know what would be most conducive for them, whether at a more community-based level or whether it's something that is more precise and more specific that is medical treatment-based.
Dr. Laurie, can we look at sort of the other end of the spectrum? Florida State University is doing something really interesting with premature babies. Can you give us that example of how music therapy is
Absolutely.
Used?
Absolutely. The professor that Indra and I both worked with during our training is one of the pioneers in NICU music therapy. And so in NICU music therapy...
Sorry, just NICU is the neonatal...
Intensive care unit. Yes, neonatal intensive care unit. In NICU music therapy, you work with infants that are born prematurely. Often, you know, some of these infants are born at 24, 25 weeks gestational age, as well as infants who may have various healthcare conditions and have not been able to be discharged from the hospital. So they could be preterm or full-term infants, and you're addressing through music developmental needs. So, for example, there are a number of techniques that help infants learn how to tolerate stimulation in the environment because their neurological systems are not developed fully yet. They're mm-hmm. born too early for that to be the case. And before they can go home, they have to be able to do things like eat on their own. And so we help them develop the skills, be it to tolerate stimulation, to develop a suck reflex mm-hmm. through music. And so we're essentially helping them progress developmentally when mm-hmm. we go in and work with the infants.
Okay. So how would music therapy look like? How do those sessions look like?
What does it look like? Mm-hmm. In a NICU, it's very much one-to-one because each baby is so fragile and mm-hmm. has such individualized needs. So mm-hmm. most of the time it is a one-to-one application. And we identify as part of the treatment team what their immediate needs are and address those first. And it might involve singing to an infant. That might be all they can tolerate. It may even be just humming to the infant. It may be using a device that we call the PAL, which is pacifier-assisted lullaby. And that device actually, when an infant sucks, turns music on. When they stop sucking, the music goes off.
Mm, so there's a motivation.
It is. Oh. It goes back to that reward and motivation that we talked about earlier. So very, very quickly, they learn that if I want the music to play, I have to keep sucking. Mm. And sucking is an important developmental milestone because it allows them to feed, but sucking is also important for self-pacification. That's why we give them pacifiers. Mm-hmm. And so they need that ability to both soothe themselves and to be able to feed to go home. There are other techniques where we use tactile stimulation paired with music. We often teach parents to use music. So they might do kangaroo care, which is laying the baby on bare skin. Mm-hmm. And they might hum or sing while doing that, because then the infant is not only getting the tactile stimulation, but they're also getting the auditory stimulation. So there are a number of different techniques that we would use.
Okay. I'm speaking to Dr. Laurie Gooding, Assistant Professor of Music Therapy from Florida State University, and Dr. Indra Selvaraja, Medical Music Therapist from University Putra, Malaysia, about medical music therapy today. We've heard really interesting examples of how it would be used in people recovering from stroke, and also for premature babies to help them catch up in terms of their development. And so when we come back from the break, I'd just like to go a little bit into what is the future that we can see for medical music therapy in Malaysia. How feasible would it be to go beyond what is being done now, to go beyond the sort of informal ways of using music in medicine and really try to systematize it. And of course, we have to talk about what the Malaysian Society for Music in Medicine is doing. So we'll be right back after this quick break on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoyik, talking about medical music therapy today with Dr. Laurie Gooding, Assistant Professor of Music Therapy from Florida State University, and Dr. Indra Selvaraja, Medical Music Therapist from University Putra, Malaysia. Before the break, Dr. Laurie, you were describing how music therapy would be used in the setting of the neonatal intensive care wards to help premature babies with their developmental progress. And I've spoken to NICU nurses, pediatric neonatologists, and parents of preemies, and they all talk about the power of music. And a lot of the parents I know do things like they sing and they play music and all that. But what would it take, Dr. Indra, for us to be able to systematize something like this? Overall, what do we need to do to look at making medical music therapy part of mainstream healthcare?
One of the things that I've been encouraged by since coming back is there seems to be not just interest in developing better ways to incorporate music into healthcare, coming from the university's perspective, because that is one of our jobs. That's why the government sent me to get the training. But on the other hand, on the part of the general hospitals, we do find that the doctors themselves have been pretty aware of the potential in music therapy to help to complement and spur treatment. So Cheras Rehab was one of the universities that approached me. And
the
they are the ones. Yes, Cheras Rehab Hospital. And so we've been working together ever since we started organizing these group music therapy sessions in the neuro rehab unit. And we are now on course to actually develop a more systematic program. So what I really like is I get to work with the hospital setup and the medical team. In fact, we'll be going over to visit the medical team to talk about the next phase of the program, which will put into place a more systematic process and hopefully a proper full-blown implementation of what a music therapy process should look like. I'm very, very keen to work together with the medical doctors and the rest of the medical team, because ultimately we have to comply with Ministry of Health requirements. And so one thing that UPM is very, very strong in us, of course, because we are a research university and we do have our own ethics board, and we have a lot of rigorous procedures to also ensure that the implementation of anything that we do as a university is also in line with what the policies and the regulations are. So that is a framework that will ultimately lay the foundation and structure for the work that we are building up, working very, very closely with the hospitals themselves.
Is there a framework that regulates music therapists in Malaysia?
At the moment, we don't have anything enforced. When 2016, there was the setting up of the Malaysian Music Therapy Association, and I started some preliminary work, and my colleagues and I, because there are a few of us in music therapy, in fact, some who have been pioneers here, as you mentioned just now, from more than 20 years back. And so I was very, very keen, and it was very much something that ultimately seemed to be a necessity for us to set about some framework for professional standards. So I started the document then, and it's subsequently been refined. It's still going through its refinement and editing, but a lot of it also is pegged to the fact that at some point, there needs to be a training program that's going to be implemented in Malaysia. Because at this point, for all of us who had the benefit of training overseas, we also recognize that not everyone is going to be able. I mean, we're trying to do our part right now in UPM to create the career pathway and to provide Malaysian students the access and the affordability to at least begin their training in music therapy. But we know that if we really, really want to put things in place, we need to train an army. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that the Malaysian Society of Music and Medicine is looking into, but we also have the Malaysian Music Therapy Association. And I also want to mention that because I think a lot of my colleagues who are music therapists have been doing a lot of work. And most of them at this point are working as private practice music therapists. But all this is actually accumulative work that has been the contribution of therapists over the years. And it's just nice to see where there is some recognition and hopefully better support. Because I think, and one of the reasons for the formation of the Music Therapy Association in 2016 was we needed that collective momentum. We can't just be working in our individual silos. And so we have to band together our resources. And now with the MMTA and the MSMM, I think there is more potential to build that momentum from slightly different perspectives, but very much working in ways that complement, to just provide that mass so that we can hopefully better advocate for music therapy, continue to do the education, and in the process, laying the groundwork here in Malaysia.
So how many members of this army do we currently have?
In terms of the actual music therapists, I would say we have around 20 plus right now.
In Malaysia.
But unfortunately, some of them have also recently, and this is something that saddens me a lot, some also move on to Singapore.
Right.
So it's a matter of that, you know, I hope that in the short term, as much as in the long run, we can find better solutions in Malaysia so that we can support our therapists and we can also provide. I mean, I've been involved a lot with, you know, trying to spur job creations, because when I know of music therapists that are coming back, at the same time, I know of facilities who may have approached me and said they're looking for music therapy. Then I try to see if there's a way to match up and help to develop a position. And I know some of the other music therapists are doing that as well. So to whatever extent, we can also open up these avenues to help our fellow therapists, but to provide legitimate employment opportunities. I work a lot with organizations that come to me looking for therapy support. And my understanding with them is always, I come here to set up the program, I train, but I hope in the long run, you will actually hire these therapists full time. Mm. Because it needs to also be a paid position. They need to be able to sustain themselves. And a lot of what's happening right now is still preliminary, but it definitely is moving in the right direction.
What is the story in the US, Dr. Laurie, in terms of professionalizing the field?
So in the United States, we first had training, it started in the 1940s. So we have a much greater span of time. So we have a much larger number of music therapists. We have over 8,000 in the United States. And what our regulations in the states vary from state to state.
Of course.
So they have licensure in some states, title protection in others. It varies based on the state laws and various applications. But across the board, our music therapists have to pass a board certification exam. Mm. So once we complete the training, we then sit for the board certification exam. And upon passing that, you get the credentials MTBC, which stands for Music Therapist Board Certified. Mm-hmm. And that enables you to practice. And every 5 years, we have to complete a certain amount of continuing education to maintain that certification so that we stay current with the new developments in the field.
Mm, yeah. And there are many developments.
Absolutely.
It looks like there's so much research and there's so much more to explore, isn't it? Very, very different fields of medicine and therapy that music would be used in. But a little bit about the Malaysian Society for Music and Medicine, Dr. Mm-hmm. Indra, if you could. Well, you've talked about the Malaysian Music Therapy Associations. How are they different and what kind of work are the two bodies doing?
Well, actually, the Malaysian Society of Music and Medicine was established in 2012, while the Malaysian Music Therapy Association was founded in 2016. But what was started by the Malaysian Society of Music and Medicine, I have to give credit to a visionary medical doctor. Her name was Dr. Sharon Chong, and she was the founder. And she actually was a musician as well, a very passionate one. And she was able to somehow bring together a group of like-minded medical doctors, but also music therapists and also university academicians. And so when I came back in end of 2013, this was already established, and I was invited to join them. And I found that it was actually very exciting because on one hand, we have a platform that is bringing together that interdisciplinary team and laying the groundwork for doing certain things in music therapy. But on the other hand, there were certain things that, in terms of pure music therapy, also needed to have its own professional set of expectations. It had to have its standards of practice and eventually its own program of training and board certification. So it was necessary also to have a formalized music therapy association that could work in complement with the Malaysian Society of Music and Medicine, which in many ways is also championing the therapeutic uses of music. And there are a few of us who are music therapists who are also in the MSMM. But because of the professional requirements of the field of music therapy, looking down the road, I actually was encouraging that we should set up that association just to be able to formalise and facilitate that structured preparation of program and training down the road. But in so many ways, they complement.
You know, there's Malaysia is in the process and has been for a long time trying to get the Allied Health Professions Act. It has been gazetted, if I'm not mistaken, but implementation, they need a lot of, they need to draft the standards and all that. Would medical music therapists come under the Allied Health Professions Act?
Ideally, both the music therapists as well as, because music therapists are allied health therapists as well, we should all fall under that. I know that when music therapy was first included, it was under traditional and complementary medicine. So that's actually because we went and did the research. We tried to find out whether, when there was the setting up of the MSMM, because that came before the MMTA, where was music therapy acknowledged? And we found it, lo and behold, in the annals of the Ministry of Health under traditional and complementary medicine. We still can't fully figure out how it got there. But it was a start, and at least it was recognised. Right. But the move, of course, is ideally towards allied healthcare.
Right. So currently, it's still parked under TCM. Okay. Is there any progress being made there, do you know?
That's a pertinent question. I think that is something which we've been working towards, but with a change of government as well. We are also waiting to see what are some of the implications, but that's definitely on the table.
Okay. So we were talking a little bit about research. What areas of research in medical music therapy, Dr. Laurie, are you looking forward to seeing?
All of them. No, there's some great research happening in terms of rehab, biopsychosocial care. I've had the opportunity to do some, particularly with anxiety in healthcare settings and things like that. And I currently am doing research on military personnel and music therapy because of they have a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge need. So for us in the United States, it is furthering the research that's already been done, developing new strands, and perhaps most importantly, being more intentional about the elements of music that are most helpful. So that, in all honesty, is what I look forward to the most. Is it the rhythm? Is it the pitch? Is it combinations? Is it the social interaction? What's really the effective parameter or parameters that's allowing music to be a therapeutic tool? And that's really exciting because the more that we know about that, the better we will be in terms of designing interventions that meet the needs of our patients.
So do you think that in some cases it could be only one of the elements, or do they all work together?
I think that's a That's a great question, and it's one that I don't know that I know the answer to. I think there are, the answer is probably some of both. So, for example, there's a concept called entrainment, and that's when you rhythmically line up with an external beat. And so when you're doing something like motor rehab, teaching someone to walk again, the beat becomes extremely important because that's what helps individuals move systematically, move fluidly, move in time. Mm-hmm. But you also have to consider things like the motivational aspects of music. So the music itself, the beat, may be helping me move in time, but I'm more likely to move in time to a song that I'm motivated to just move to begin with. So I don't know that you can separate one from the other, but knowing which elements are impacting which aspect of the treatment will help us better know how to use them collectively.
Actually, that brings me to a question I wanted to ask earlier. What kind of music forms are generally used in music therapy?
The research has shown that patient-preferred music is the most effective.
Right.
So we used music that the patients relate to, and that can be often is heavily tied in with culture. But in addition to that, we also look at the parameters of music itself, so things like tempo, how fast or slow. Form comes into play in terms of whether it's a verse-chorus format or whether it's moving in 4-4 time or 3-4 time, so you move in groups of 4 or 3. And you take all of those elements and put them together based on the goal that you're trying to reach.
Okay. And Dr. Indra, in terms of, as Dr. Laurie mentioned, the aspect of what's culturally mm-hmm. relevant, how much of a difference does that make to you in your work using music that resonates with a local population?
It is extremely important. Whenever I've gone into Chiraz Rehab, and I've always taught my students to be able to monitor, because we spend a lot of time choosing the music because we want to make sure that there's a right balance between the ages, between the different conditions, but also with the ethnicities. And for the most part, we find that if we can find ways to incorporate local music, we're talking about folk songs, we're talking about old Malaysian favourites, you know, we're talking about P. Ramlee, we're talking about Sudirman and so forth, it inevitably changes the atmosphere and the level of responsiveness. Mm-hmm. And it's very exciting for me when I can find a song which I feel cuts across all the ethnicities. And the level of response just somehow is so much stronger because there is that certain cultural identification, a familiarity, and it's almost as if it brings out a response, whether it's at a subconscious level as well, but very much as part of their cultural conditioning. They definitely do resonate better, it seems. Of course, we'd like to do more research into it. For the most part, a lot of us who are Western trained, of course, mm-hmm. are very familiar with a lot of Western repertoire. We use a lot of, you know, folk music, we use classical music, we use pop music especially. Mm-hmm. But if we could have more of a repertory of our own Malaysian folk music or traditional music, and we explored the use of angklung as well, and we are seeking ways to actually engage further research and collaboration to develop more avenues for our traditional music to be incorporated into the therapeutic application.
So what's your favourite song to use? Local song?
I would say anything P. Ramlee seems to be, it has that universal appeal. At the same time, when you talk about, you know, if we were to have artists like Teresa Teng, that cuts across very well with especially Mandarin-speaking populations. Mm-hmm. Or I mentioned just now Sudirman as well. Mm-hmm. But I do sometimes, because if I'm working in a neuro rehab setting, and I find that for some of them, some level of cognitive stimulation, because where there is memory impairment, there is confusion, we try to use music as a tool to sometimes stimulate their reality orientation. Mm. And I do try to bring in songs that I know are currently trendy, perhaps, that you would hear often in the radio, to try to use this as a hook and to help them, to draw them into their current awareness and engage them. Because the whole point of it is, as we are using the music, it's a therapeutic process that is underlying, that is helping them to achieve whatever goal that we have pinpointed, but in a way that also helps them to better self-regulate and comply with their ongoing treatment.
Mm, okay. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Do you have a final message on the future of music therapy?
I know that a lot of people right now are interested in music therapy, and where there are things that perhaps are still yet to be understood. I think the Malaysian Society of Music and Medicine is really trying to promote this discourse and better understanding of the therapeutic uses of music, particularly in medical contexts, as well as other health settings, but also to help us to work together, whether through research, whether through clinical application, to also improve the efficacy of treatment outcomes while reducing cost of care. Because I think that's a major, major concern right now, where a lot of people who need treatment are also finding the cost of living escalating. And so one of the things that we have not yet had a chance to mention, but there's research to show that music therapy is actually something that contributes towards the cost benefit. That is already a body of existing research that is being recorded in the US. And so we are talking about improving treatment outcomes while reducing cost of care, and also, of course, improving patients' quality of life, well-being, their coping, their compliance to treatment. All these things are really important, and that can really, really enhance the treatment outcome as a whole. Last but not least, if I could just encourage people to log on to the Malaysian Society of Music and Medicine Facebook page and our webpage as well, because there is a lot that we're doing right now that's not just talking about the ways that we can focus on a disease-based focus of treatment, but we are also looking at the salutogenic approach, which looks at the uses of music to optimize our health. So we are as much interested in preventative measures and ways in which we can help to keep people healthier using music before they have any kind of early onset of disease. And if there is a way to actively incorporate music into our everyday lifestyles in a way that preserves our health, that promotes wellness, it just means that we can prevent a lot of diseases from manifesting at that earlier stage.
The goal of our entire healthcare system, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Dr. Laurie, do you have a final message?
You know, it's just exciting for me as someone from the United States to engage and see the development of music therapy across the globe, and particularly here in Malaysia. And it's exciting that I get to be a part of that. And I appreciate so much what I'm learning from engaging, and in particular, some of the similarities through what we've gone through in the United States that are happening here in Malaysia.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Dr. Laurie Gooding, Assistant Professor of Music Therapy from Florida State University, and Dr. Indra Salvaraja, Medical Music Therapist from University Putra, Malaysia. You've been listening to Health and Living on A Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.